Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We have as our first case this morning, 048P958CR and 048P1609CR, State versus Bill Doyle. Is that Marquardt? Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Marquardt, will be Patricia Fitzgerald for 15 minutes, and then we're going to have Assistant Attorney General Freimuth arguing for the State of Wisconsin for 30, and then Mr. Brinkman, you're going to be arguing on behalf of Mr. Marquardt for 15. We have two cases here today. Okay. Is that satisfactory with you all? All right. We'll start with the Attorney Fitzgerald.
Morning. My name is Pat Fitzgerald, and I represent Bill Marquardt in the Eau Claire case. This case involves a bare-bones affidavit for a warrant. There was absolutely no indicia of probable cause. As the Court of Appeals held, the facts in the affidavit, there was nothing in the facts in the affidavit to tie Marquardt to the crime of the homicide of his mother, much less to tie his home to that crime. This case, the search warrant was issued to search his home. The question is, does the good faith exception apply? Now, according to Leon, the inquiry should be confined to whether a reasonably well-trained officer would have known that the search was illegal despite the magistrate's authorization.
Can I stop you for just a minute? Was the search that you're arguing about the search of the home where the victim was found, or was it the home of the defendant?
The home of the defendant.
So we're talking about the cabin.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. While there's several issues that have been raised and briefed, I'd like to focus on a couple of those issues because of the lack of time. The first issue I'd like to focus on is whether the police can go outside the warrant to justify good faith. We concede that there are cases, federal cases, that go both ways. However, I believe that there are several important policy reasons for holding a bright line rule that the courts will not look outside the warrant affidavits. First of all, is judicial economy. If we allow the state to present evidence outside the warrant affidavits, you get into the whole question of whether, you know, memories have faded, credibility of the witnesses. It just is a larger hassle if you take evidence outside the warrant.
Counselor, isn't there a precedent for taking evidence outside the warrant when we look at, for example, a no-knock warrant and the officers, even though they may have validly obtained it at the time, can't execute it as a no-knock warrant if those circumstances no longer exist and the officers know that?
Yes.
And why shouldn't we apply that reasoning?
Because a well-trained officer should know that the warrant has to have probable cause. And, you know, in a case of a no-knock, a well-trained officer knows that if there's exigent circumstances, he may go in.
Those are circumstances after the warrant and after the affidavit on the no-knock.
Right.
Here, the circumstances are in existence at the time of the affidavit.
So the state claims.
Okay.
And, you know, if we're in a situation where we have a warrant and the officers are well-trained officers, they know that they can't bring evidence in to rehabilitate the warrant later, even if it's evidence that they knew at the time. So why are you going to let them make the end run and allow them to bring evidence of good faith in as to the indicia of probable cause? In that case, they don't even have to show probable cause. You're telling them, you don't even have to show probable cause. You have to show just good faith. So that allows them to make an end run if they present an adequate warrant.
Ma'am, in your brief, in the appendix to your brief, you have this police report from the Chippewa County Sheriff's Department right at the end, 7 pages. And that entire Sheriff's Department report really stems from an interview on the 13th of March. And unfortunately, it didn't get typed up, I don't believe, until probably the 20th of March.
I have to check the date. That's actually, there were two reports typed up, and the second report is even more extensive. But yes, that's the case, that this one wasn't typed up, or signed at least, until the 20th.
Well, your position is that all of this information that was in the head of one of the two officers that was supplying information to the officer who sought a search warrant, that none of that information should be available to the police to justify their good faith in executing the warrant. Is that correct?
I believe that the warrant itself, I mean, they had this information available. If there was anything in here, which I do not believe there is, but if there was anything in here that was connecting Bill to the murder of his mother and his home to the murder of his mother, they should put that in the warrant. That's what you require for probable cause. Why are you going to let them, for purposes of good faith, make an end run around that?
Well, when was the warrant signed by the circuit court?
It was signed, I believe, around 11:50 on the 15th.
That's right. It would have been so easy if this officer had been present before the judge and there had been time for a hearing and someone recording that hearing. There could have been lots of follow-up questions. The information just would have spilled out. 11:59... Boy, I think that's kind of like almost lunchtime. Maybe there wasn't time for a hearing. Maybe they needed to get in there for some reason. Do we know exactly what was exchanged between the judge and the people seeking the warrant, the officer seeking the warrant?
According to the testimony of the officer seeking the warrant, the judge just looked at the warrant and he said he took about 10 minutes. There were no questions asked. And he signed the warrant, and the officer brought it back to the DA. There were no questions asked.
If I can follow up on what Justice Prosser was asking you, I was just thinking about, and hopefully we didn't do it wrong or in a wrong manner when we did these in Brown County, but I'm just thinking, I had 19 years on the trial bench, and during that time it was frequent to have the district attorney or an assistant district attorney come in along with police officers and ask for the issuance of a search warrant. And usually what went on was that there was a discussion where the officers would explain what was going on, give you a context for the situation, and then you'd be presented with the search warrant and the affidavit. And you'd require the officer to swear under oath before the court and sign the affidavit. That was usually done in front of the judge. But there was lots of information that would be presented which would give the judge a picture of the situation that wasn't necessarily in the affidavit. And it strikes me that if you're going to say that for the purposes of good faith, you can't allow the information that was known to the officers and may very well have been presented to the magistrate, to the judge. If you exclude that information, I think you're going contrary to, in reality, the way these things are issued, the way things actually occur in fact. And I think that's what Justice Prosser was asking you about as well. Why is it not appropriate to, when looking at good faith, to allow a presentation
in terms of what the officers actually knew at the time.
I think what you're saying that if it had been presented to the magistrate, yeah, that's one thing. But here, nothing was presented to the magistrate.
And you said there was about 10 minutes with the judge.
But the officer who went in said that there was no exchange. He brought the affidavit in. The judge read it. He said he read it for about 10 minutes. And then he signed the affidavit. The officer gave it back and went back to the district attorney. The district attorney didn't go in with him. There was, according to the officer, there was no exchange of information.
The officer didn't say anything to him. He just came in and said, here you are, Judge. And it took him 10 minutes to read that short affidavit.
Well, that's what the officer says. I don't know, you know, that's what the officer said at the suppression hearing, whether that's true or not.
But even if we accept that as true, as you know, whatever rule comes out of this case will apply to other cases as well. And I'm having trouble understanding why we should exclude information that was known to the officer in determining whether or not the officers acted in good faith, because that's what the focus is.
Because you have to look at, the officers are supposed to know that the warrant is adequate, or believe, have good faith to believe the warrant is adequate, not that some theoretical warrant could be adequate.
Well, but here you had a situation, as I understand it, where the district attorney, Ray Pellrine, had actually prepared the affidavit and the search warrant. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So you have, we said in Eason, you've got to have two things. You've got to have, one, a sufficient investigation. And the document that Justice Prosser was referring to would indicate there was a extensive investigation. And secondly, as I understand it, you have to have an officer with knowledge of what's required for probable cause or a legal trained person, such as the district attorney, who reviewed the information and felt it was sufficient. So apparently, if Ray Pellrine prepared this, he must have thought it was sufficient, even though later it was found not to be sufficient.
Yeah, but you're forgetting that we also have to look, before we look at the Eastern requirements, we have to look at the Leon requirement.
Oh, I understand that.
And the Leon requirement requires that there be sufficient, or at least no lack of sufficient probable cause in the affidavit or the information that's presented to the magistrate. And if there's no adequate indicia of probable cause presented to the magistrate, then you don't even get to the Leon requirement. You don't even get to the Eason requirement.
And Leon, wasn't the conclusion that so much of the information was stale that it couldn't relate to and would not be sufficient to justify a showing of probable cause?
Correct.
And yet, because of the good faith of the officers, the U.S. Supreme Court said it was okay.
But there was a nexus. There was a nexus in the Leon affidavit that connected the people and the place to be searched, the places to be searched, to the crime. There was not probable cause. It's questionable whether after Illinois versus Gates, even that warrant would have had probable cause. But in this particular instance, we don't have anything, either in the affidavit or presented to the magistrate, that would suggest that Bill Marquardt or his house had anything to do with the murder of his mother. And so under those circumstances, you don't even get to whether or not there was a significant investigation or whether they presented, whether a DA or a properly trained officer prepared the affidavit. Now, further, as far as investigation, significant investigation, I think what you have to have there is some nexus as well. I think what you want to do is you want to make sure that your rule, whatever it is, encourages that affidavits actually do have probable cause. The good faith exception should not be an end run around probable cause. The good faith exception should apply where an officer really has a good reason to believe that the affidavit or the information presented to the magistrate is adequate. And if there is no such reason to believe the information is adequate, then there's no basis for that officer to have probable cause in executing the warrant.
Well, you said there was a division among the courts as to the application of other evidence outside the affidavit. What's the reasoning of the courts that agree with you? What's the reasoning of the courts that disagree with you?
Well, for example, the State versus Martin, or not, United States versus Martin, what that court does is it looked at the affidavit to determine whether there was any indicia of probable cause. And in that particular case, they found that there was indicia of probable cause. And then they decided, well, we look at this, and then to determine probable cause, to determine good faith, we can look at the information outside the affidavits. And they did that in that particular instance. But they first found that there was adequate indicia of probable cause in the
There was good faith in accepting that. But aren't there any cases that say, hey, this was a bad affidavit, no probable cause, no reasonable officer would think it was a good search warrant, but the officer had other information at the time of the warrant that would be probable cause. Is there any such case?
Is that possible that United States versus Marion, and I don't have the facts of that totally in mind. I do know that in that case they looked at information outside the warrant application without making a finding that there was an indicia of probable cause in the warrant. And then, of course, we've got United States versus Kurth, that says that you just look at the warrant affidavit.
What does United States versus Tasker say?
Pardon?
There's a case, an 11th Circuit case, United States versus Tasker, 902 Federal Second. It's cited, I think, by somebody here, maybe the state. Do you know what? You might not remember it. There are
I know that the Martin Court used it as previous precedent for looking outside the warrant, but right now I can't remember exactly how they used
That's
it.
Fine. Thank you, Ms. Fitzgerald. Mr. Farmer.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the State in these consolidated criminal appeals. In the Eau Claire case, the State is the respondent, and that's the animal cruelty case. And in the Chippewa case, the homicide case, the State is the appellant. The link between the two cases is a March 15th search warrant that was executed at Defendant Mark Wirt's cabin in Eau Claire County. That warrant stemmed from an investigation into the homicide of his mother that occurred 2 days earlier, March 13th. So the homicide is March 13th. March 15th is the search warrant at the cabin. As a result of that search warrant, an arrest warrant was issued based on animal cruelty charges and the discovery of the animal carcasses in Eau Claire County. And that arrest warrant was then executed on March 18th outside the cabin where they arrested Marquardt. That arrest in turn led to blood evidence further linking Mr. Marquardt to the Chippewa County homicide.
What did the officers know when they went and got the Eau Claire search warrant? What did they actually know?
The original March 15th warrant?
No.
There's a fund of knowledge that includes both what was in the warrant application and then what they knew but failed to include in that application.
The defense counsel says very clearly this is bare bones. There's nothing there. And I apologize, I stepped out for a minute, but Justice Crooks was asking, well, look, they had a discussion. The opposing counsel, the picture we get is that a officer walked in front of the judge. There was nothing discussed, and the judge read it for 10 minutes. He picked up the warrant and walked out. Is that your impression of what happened?
The testimony at the Eau Claire good faith hearing, which occurred a couple of years after the fact, was to that effect that the sergeant from Eau Claire, actually preliminary to that, the sergeant from Eau Claire, the DCI agent or agent from from Addison, and the investigator from Chippewa County all got together with then Eau Claire District Attorney Pellrine to discuss this. District Attorney Pellrine then drafted that warrant application, gave it to Mr. Vogler, and he gave it to Judge Proctor in Eau Claire. And according to the testimony at the good faith hearing, that review took Judge Proctor approximately 10 minutes. In the brief, we've had two opportunities to really list all the information that's involved here since the same warrant is involved in the two appeals. But I'd be happy to list, and this gives me, I guess, an opportunity to suggest what the state's alternative positions are. First, we're not going away, and we strongly believe that the warrant application itself, just looking at the contents of that March 15th search warrant application, was more than bare bones under the good faith Leon requirement.
Let's just...
Sure.
Is the state saying that there was probable cause here?
We argued that initially, and the Court of Appeals rejected that,
okay.
And that's gone.
So you accept that this was not good enough
for
the warrant?
We accept... I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm
Happily
sorry.
You accept it. Unhappily.
Unhappily. That's what I was trying to say. Yes.
You accept it. So the issue here is whether you come into an exception when you have a search of a house when there isn't a valid warrant, right?
Correct.
And the two exceptions are good faith and inevitable discovery.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, we're talking about
good
faith.
The state's position. Okay. The good faith argument is actually a two-part deal. One is the one where you look purely at the warrant application itself. That's, you don't have to worry about whether you can look outside the warrant or not. If this court agrees that this is sufficient for good faith based purely on that, good enough, then we don't get to this second question about looking outside of it. One point that I want to make sure that I don't forget to make here is when you've got additional information that the officers had here in advance of the warrant application that doesn't make it in, well, either that information has to stand for something. There's no misconduct involved for not including it. It's either negligence, sloppy, oversight, whatever it might be, and whoever might, whether it's the district attorney drafting it, whatever the reason for that. But you still got good information that was acquired in advance. That information either then should be considered in a good faith analysis, but if it isn't, if this warrant had been denied, the officers would have just looked at what they had, reapplied immediately, and had the probable cause to get the warrant. So, I mean, it doesn't make sense to exclude that.
Let me ask you about that. I'm looking at United States versus Korth, where Judge Coffey cites from United States versus Leon and hit Section C of that opinion. If a defendant is successful in establishing the invalidity of a warrant, the burden then shifts to the government to establish that the police relied in good faith on the judge's decision to accept the affidavit and issue the warrant. Now, if you're conceding that there's no probable cause in the affidavit and in the warrant, then it's hard for me to see under the court analysis how an officer can rely in good faith on that affidavit and warrant. And so I guess my question is a little bit different. And you haven't argued this, and I was kind of curious why you didn't. And maybe it's because there's a problem missing here. But if you go back to the stage, and I agree with you that perhaps the police ought to be able to look at information that it had, but don't you then go back to the stage where you don't have a warrant and one of the exceptions might be probable cause and exigent circumstances? And if that's so, are there any exigent circumstances here?
We didn't argue exigent circumstances here. I mean, this was 2 days after the homicide. I may have tried to locate Mr. Markwood, so we didn't argue exigent circumstances as an alternative basis for getting into the cabin. I don't know if this information that we're relying on for either inevitable discovery or for good faith would have provided a justification that an emergency was, all I can tell you in hindsight is that I doubted whether there was, I guess, exigent circumstances.
But if there had been exigent circumstances, that would be a way to look at that information independent of the warrant, correct?
Certainly. Certainly.
What about consent to search from the father?
That is not developed on the record. I think there would be an argument as a co-owner, I believe, of the cabin that perhaps that might have been elicited. As far as I understand the record, no That was not solicited. They didn't ask him for consent, as far as I know. At least the record isn't developed on that particular alternative exception to the warrant requirement.
Now, if we accepted the state's position that it's okay to look outside the application for information in existence at the time of the application, but not part of the affidavit, if we accept that, as I understand the position, what happens if Officer A knows this, but it's Officer B, who only has the affidavit in front of him, has no outside information? Officer B does the search. A usual rule is whatever one person in the department knows, everybody knows. I'm not going to press it too hard, but what happens here?
Well, that would be the argument that I would make, that this is all part of the general knowledge of the applying officers.
What's the use, then, of having this warrant charade and application?
Well,
as a circuit court judge, listen, I'm busy. It's a waste of my time. Get out of here. Because it seems to me you're arguing that even if there's no probable cause in the application and the warrant, as long as it existed in the officer's mind, or as the chief is now suggesting, God forbid, in some other officer that's 3 miles away, you know, but it's communicated, you know, because of our legal fictions that one knows, the other knows, then that's sufficient. Why would you ever need a warrant if probable cause can be found in the minds of the police officer?
Well, there's two different things going on. The first is the magistrate. You want some intervention. The purpose of the warrant requirement, of course, is the intervention of a neutral judicial officer.
That's right.
So
to protect the individual involved.
That's correct.
And it's just...
That's correct. And that is exactly why, in the case law, it's considered either presumptive or prima facie, however you want to characterize it, that when they apply for the warrant, they're doing so because they are looking for that judicial intervention.
And as a judge, my understanding of the law, and, every once in a while I might be wrong, but as a judge, when I was a circuit court judge, my understanding of the law is that the warrant could only issue if there was probable cause, and the probable cause had to be based only on sworn testimony, whether or not that was sworn testimony set forth in the affidavit, or as we did sometimes, the officer came in, the DA came in, my court reporter came in, question answers, I find probable cause because there's sworn testimony. Is that your understanding of the law, that probable cause can only issue based on sworn testimony?
Absolutely, and that's why when you review probable cause in an affidavit, when the reviewing court looks at it, they're looking at what the magistrate had or the judge had before he or she in determining that.
Under oath?
Under oath. Sure. But the good faith exception then was developed by the U.S. Supreme Court and then seconded by this court in Eason to address the situation where you have a warrant that doesn't satisfy probable cause, but what the officers did, which included applying for the warrant as they were supposed to, that what they did was in good faith in doing that application. There was no deterrent effect for penalizing officers who behave in accordance with what the law requires. There's no deterrent effect for penalizing officers for not including something favorable in their warrant application. They're not going to routinely do that. I suggest that the fact that this situation hasn't arisen very often and that this is still an edge case where you've got a split of authority whether you can look outside the warrant is simply because that doesn't happen very often. Usually everything is put in there, or I shouldn't say usually. In theory, everything that would support a warrant is going to be in there. What happens, though, when you've got a situation where, and I hesitate again because our first argument here is that this was good enough for good faith without looking at what wasn't in the application. But what happens when you've got a close call? And a close call here, not just in terms of probable cause, but in terms of whether the warrant application itself was or was not bare bones. And here, when you've got the additional information that would give you not only to get over the bare bones hurdle for good faith, but also probable cause. The state's suggestion here is that when you're looking outside if you look outside the warrant. What standard are you going to say is good enough for good faith when you do that? And the state's position here is that so long as the total sum of the information in the application and the information that was omitted that was favorable, if that amounts to more than bare bones, that should be enough. But even if this court is inclined to say that it should be, that this total sum should add up to probable cause, even that is here when you look at the totality of the information.
Can I ask, in your red brief on page 9, as you recount facts, you say an officer said Alford had reported on March 15th that Marquardt had the .22 rifle at the cabin.
I'm sorry, at page 9 of the...
Nine,
my red brief?
Your red
brief. Oh, I see. Okay, I see.
Did the officers have that information from the father before the search warrant or after the search warrant?
That particular information, I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to look at the March 13th report. I just don't have a recollection off the top of my head whether that was in that, was in the police report of March 13th that you referred to earlier, whether that information was in there or not.
It's not in there.
It's not in there. Okay.
That's a statement from March 13th.
And, sure. That the report was dated March 13th, based on the discussion with the defendant's father occurred on March 13th, immediately after the discovery of a homicide. I don't, if it's not in that report, and I think there's a second report that a different officer also prepared, and if it's not in there, then the only place that information would be known would be from the good faith hearing testimony, and I just don't recall seeing that. We have not argued that that .22 caliber comment from the father to the police was part of the analysis of for the good faith and for sufficient information. There's other, I think, more compelling information, and I would certainly like to go through all that. It's repeated twice in the briefs, given the double briefing on this.
What are the elements of, what are the knowledge, what's the knowledge as of the date of the application that were omitted from the application that you think support good faith? Just tick them off, okay?
Sure.
You want to tick them off, don't you?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
The opportunity, I appreciate it. Okay, and this information, I should also clarify, this is the information that was obtained during testimony, either in the police report, either in the police report or during the testimony at the good faith hearing. This is the information. First, on the day of the homicide, a message for Bill Marquardt had been attached to the refrigerator in his parents' home. The investigator discovered on that date of the homicide, March 13th, that it was no longer there. And they found it, I guess, a few days later under a jewelry box in the bedroom. But the suggestion that the state seeks to draw from that, or the inference that the state seeks to convey, is that he had been in the house, Bill Marquardt, because the message was for him and it was
the mother's house.
The mother's house.
All right. And he put it under the mother's jewelry box.
Well, somebody did. Yeah. Second, on the day after the homicide, this is March 14th, and the day before the March 15th warrant, an investigator learned that Bill Marquardt's neighbor's dog had recently been shot with a 9mm caliber gun, and the bullet casings that were there were similar to, at least in caliber, to the 9mm shell that was found at the homicide scene. Now, the fact that Bill Marquardt lives next to the residence of where the dog was shot, and that it's also his mother who was shot, and that this is the same caliber bullet that's being used, I think, also supports the proposition that at least the probable cause that he was involved in this. Thirdly, officers knew in advance of the warrant application that Bill Marquardt had a prior history of, quote, drug dealings, and that his mother recently had caught him digging up $12,000 in cash on the parents' property. This information, when coupled with everything else, suggested a possible motive, that maybe the mother had confronted him on this, or threaten to go to authorities. And there's a fourth point, and something that was that is in the police report that I neglected to include in the brief on this, and that is that among the people who had keys to the residence, only Bill Marquardt among the children, only Bill and his parents, according to the police report of Investigator Price, had keys to the residence. There is no information. Also, I'm sorry, confirmed at the good faith hearing was the fact that there was no break-in, no evidence of a break-in. Also confirmed was that there was no evidence of a sexual assault. So what we're talking about here is a murder of a middle-aged married woman in the middle of the day who is found wrapped up in a blanket. And there's case law support for the proposition that this suggests that, especially when you put everything together with the absence of the break-in and so forth, that this is a perpetrator who knew his victim and, moreover, probably felt either remorse or guilt or whatever as a result of what he had done.
Mr. Freimuth, I'm looking at a requirement in U.S. versus Leon, I believe on page 923, and I just want to read this to you. Nor would an officer manifest objective good faith in relying on a warrant based on an affidavit so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence entirely unreasonable. Finally, depending on the circumstances of a particular case, a warrant may be so facially deficient in failing to particularize the place to be searched or things to be seized that the executing officers cannot reasonably presume it to be valid. Now, when I look at that language, so lacking in relying on a warrant, aren't you, in fact, arguing for a good faith exception outside of the warrant? You're not arguing for good faith on the warrant because you can't get there based on the Leon requirement. So what you're saying is that the officers ought to be able to rely on good faith that they have probable cause.
I don't think you can read Leon as narrowly, perhaps, as you're suggesting.
Isn't that how Judge Coffey reads it?
I think that's right, although I should point out in the Korth case that that was the discussion about not going outside the warrant application for good faith. That was a tag on at the end of the opinion. It wasn't necessary for that decision. It was a comment, because the state had made that argument, the court did comment on it, but it was not necessary to that. They found that the warrant application itself was sufficient in court. But in Leon itself, there are several examples of the court actually looking outside the warrant. One of the comments in Leon, I'm looking at page 922 of Leon, the court says, with respect to all four of these are negative reasons where they wouldn't apply good faith. The Supreme Court observed that, quote, all of the circumstances, including whether the warrant application had previously been rejected by a different magistrate, may be considered. Well, that's certainly outside the warrant application. In addition, certainly the Franks versus Delaware situation that was alluded to earlier at the beginning, which you're talking about whether there's false information, that's something that's going to be considered outside the warrant.
That's a separate requirement that's in Leon itself.
That's one of the separate Leon requirements, right. It doesn't go specifically to the minimal indicia of probable cause that we're talking about, but it's another example of the court suggesting that we're looking beyond just the warrant. And when we're talking about good faith, I think you can read Leon as suggesting that you can go beyond the warrant application.
Well, the misleading requirement is not a good faith requirement. It's based upon the fact that the magistrate was misled. The good faith requirement that you're arguing from the officer is where it's right, according to at least the language of Leon, where the officer can in good faith rely on the warrant. So I guess my question remains the same. I understand you're arguing good faith, but aren't you arguing good faith at warrant plus, not at warrant?
Right. I mean, when you're going past to the second step, I mean, to the second alternative argument, we're talking about looking at what the officers knew in advance of the warrant application, but for whatever reason failed to include in that. And I think the reason why that, or one of the key reasons why that is, it should be permissible under Leon, is that there's no deterrent effect. There's no reason for an officer not to include that kind of information in the warrant application. And even if this court were to conclude that We're not going to go outside the warrant application and looking at good faith. We're just going to look at, as we do in probable cause, we're just going to look at the warrant application and say either it was bare bones or it wasn't. Well, then this information, this favorable, positive information linking Mr. Marquardt to the homicide that they had in advance has to stand for something. And that's where inevitable discovery picks up, would pick up the difference. And that is that if this magistrate, if this judge had denied this, as the Court of Appeals said he should have because of lack of probable cause, the officers are going to go back, assess what they have. This is going to include the information that I just mentioned that they did already have, and is going to enable them to immediately reapply for a warrant. And given the three-day lapse here that we're talking about before Mr. Marquardt appears at his cabin, the officers are going to be in precisely the same situation, and that evidence that they seized on March 18th, or March 15th, I'm sorry, any of the evidence, is going to be still available for them to seize. So this information, this good positive information that didn't find its way into the application, is either going to be usable in good faith, or it's going to be usable in inevitable discovery.
Counselor, don't the cases on inevitable discovery generally rely on two separate and very independent efforts that would have led to the same result, rather than a retry of the same effort as you're explaining here?
Two of the criteria, you're right, two of the criteria for, or the three criteria for inevitable discovery is that there's a reasonable probability the evidence would have been discovered by lawful means but for the impropriety or misconduct. The second is that the government then possessed leads making the discovery inevitable. And the third is that the government was actively pursuing some alternative line of investigation.
Right, and it's that second part that I think you're changing just a little bit in your request to us, or that last tier, correct?
The suggestion that I have is that this is, that because they possess this additional information, although it's not technically, an alternative line of investigation, that it still fits that bill because it's information that, it's information that was not part of the warrant application. I guess that's not a very satisfactory answer, and I apologize, but it just seems to me that when you have this additional information, it's got to stand for something. There is also an additional line of inevitable discovery that fits even more clearly with those last two criteria, and that is the crime lab was analyzing the 9mm casings that were found at the neighbor's dog's shooting and then at the homicide scene. The crime lab returned a finding on March 23rd that indicated they had come from the same gun. Now, that's 5 days after the arrest, and at the time of the arrest is where the blood evidence, the trace evidence that was still on his person, on his knife, on his shoe. My suggestion is that also is a basis for admitting that evidence, that if Mr. Marquardt had not taken any pains, either because he didn't notice it or to get rid of it, in the 5 days between the homicide and when he was arrested, those additional 5 days when that ballistics information came back, which is even greater link to Mr. Marquardt to the homicide, that would also satisfy inevitable discovery.
Thank you.
Counsel, in your second argument with regard to good faith, that is going outside the affidavit and the warrant, and you mentioned the deterrent effect, perhaps in a different context. But what strikes my mind is that to relax the requirement that probable cause be under oath and set forth before a neutral magistrate, that if you say that it doesn't have to be under oath before a neutral magistrate in order to be a good warrant, because if the officer knew it, that's good enough, that's a good faith attempt. I mean, isn't that promoting sloppy conduct? Isn't that deterring, if you will, the effectuation of the goal that probable cause for a search warrant be on sworn testimony so that a neutral and detached magistrate can do it? It seems to me that you're You're encouraging bad behavior by saying as long as they know it.
I don't think so. I mean, I mean, there's no empirical information that I can say that, or even the case law is really relatively new in this area as to looking outside that for good faith. But I think the principle of good faith here encompasses that kind of scenario. In other words, looking outside the warrant application itself. And that is that if the officers had this information and really had no good reason not to include it other than just oversight, that you're really not going to, by having a rule that says put everything in there, you encourage putting everything in, but I don't think you're actually deterring anything with respect to...
Well, there are no consequences if you don't. You know, there's no consequences if you don't have probable cause.
The standard is that you still have the officers, the fund of their information has to be sufficient.
But in their mind, I'm saying there's no consequences. Who cares if they have enough in the affidavit and have enough in all, you know, just put something in there. Who cares? You don't have to care that much because if it's not in there and if it's in your mind, that's good enough.
I guess the best that I can at short notice thinking about this is that even though you don't have the contemporaneous judicial magistrate looking at all of the information because we're now looking at it at a subsequent evidentiary hearing, good faith hearing, you still have that judicial oversight. You still have the court looking at it at the evidentiary hearing on good faith. You're also going to have the further appellate review of
after
that determination.
After the home has been invaded.
Absolutely. It's after the fact, yeah.
Could you summarize what is the reasonable indicia of probable cause in the document and
itself.
Documents itself?
All right. First, the one affidavit mentions that the phone was inexplicably busy all afternoon on that day. That suggested that it was off the hook, of course. And it also, coupled with any indication in the warrant application that there was a break-in, suggested that it was probably off the hook in relationship to the ultimate homicide. Second, and also further suggested, I guess, by a further inference that in the absence of evidence of a break-in, that she probably knew her assailant. That's one of the factors. The second piece of information in the warrant application is the fact that she had been shot in the head and stabbed, coupled with the absence of information suggesting any robbery or sexual assault in the warrant application, suggested that that homicide was the sole goal of the perpetrator. Third, the use of a gun and a knife suggests that the killer was male, as does the presence of footprints suitable for comparison, which was mentioned in the warrant affidavit, and apparently that excluded the father because his boots were obtained and that no match apparently was made to him. Fourth, the fact that Mrs. Markwood's body was covered, this is one of the two significant facts tying Mr. Markwood, I think, in the warrant application itself. The fact that his mother's body was covered in the garage with a blanket suggests that the killer felt compassion for the victim or remorse for the killing, precisely because he intimately knew the victim. And finally, the fact that, according to the warrant affidavit, his father had not, or Marco had not been seen or heard from in the 2 days after the homicide, despite the publicity, suggests that he, among the victim's family and friends, best fit this other identified information, that this was an intimate person, somebody that she knew that perpetrated the homicide.
What inferences can be drawn that are helpful to the state from the fact that there was a search warrant executed for the residence where the homicide actually occurred and that all that documentation was there and that here is now a second search warrant for a different building? What inferences can be drawn from those things?
Well, the information obtained from the first search warrant was included as an attachment the application for the initial warrant, and I think the return perhaps was included as an attachment in the March 15th application. The information that was obtained on March 13th, beyond what was included in the March 15 application, would be relevant to significant investigation, the efforts that were made to try to determine who had done this, what had happened, that sort of thing. But linking the March 13th execution of that warrant at the parents' house beyond what was included in the March 15th application for the defendant's cabin. Nothing additional beyond what was in that application, unless it was information that was in the police reports and it was outside the warrant application itself. I'm not sure if that answers what you're getting at.
It seems to me an inference can be drawn that there was a search of the house where the homicide occurred, and there is material in the affidavit speaking to the father. He's not pointing his finger at the son necessarily, but I mean, he is saying this is where Bill lives, and I own that too, and there's a follow-up to those two things.
If I understand, and supportive, I guess, of the state's interest in Bill Marquardt among all the family and friends, that information.
It just seems to me one of the principal figures in all of this, the father, is not an active suspect. I mean, you talked about the shoes, for example. Maybe things are shifting over for a reason to the son and his residence.
Well, again, beyond what I've articulated, I guess I don't know of any additional information specifically in the record that other than what I articulated.
Well, Mr. Freimuth, can this court, as a matter of law, look at all the information on the record on March 15th? And say, hey, the trial court was wrong. State had probable cause. Go home. Is that before us?
Probably not, I guess, because the Court of Appeals decision, I guess, is law of the case. I'm not sure I know enough whether this, and with respect to that prior decision finding lack of probable cause, both parties petitioned this court for review. I don't know if this court would be free to revisit that.
This is your petition, good faith and inevitable discovery. I mean, we usually limit the review to the issues.
In the original Court of Appeals opinion, which found no lack or insufficient probable cause, we challenged that finding as on our petition for review. And in turn, Mr. Marquardt, on his cross petition, challenged the automobile search, I believe. And this court denied both of those petitions. Mm-hmm. Then this is now certified from the Court of Appeals in the aftermath of the good faith analysis.
Thank you.
Counsel, aren't we free to revisit any of those issues just because it's law of the case? It isn't law of the case for us, is it?
I certainly wouldn't mind reviewing the probable cause determination, certainly since the state lost that issue previously, but I just don't know of the authority that would allow the court to do that other than in its broad inherent authority.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Freimuth. Mr. Brinkman.
My name is John Brinkman, and I represent Bill Marquardt in the Chippewa County case, the homicide case. Why have a warrant at all if the officers can justify their actions after the fact in an evidentiary hearing? Because the Constitution requires it. The Fourth Amendment requires it. Now, why have a good faith? There's been a lot of consideration of good faith, a lot of talk about good faith, but in Leon requires objective good faith, not subjective good faith. An objective good faith is defined to be a good faith reliance on a document that's required by the Constitution. And in order to have a good faith reliance, there has to first be a minimal amount of indicia of good faith, which did not exist here. there has to be an analysis of what constitutes good faith, of what constitutes probable cause. There's plenty of probable cause that a crime was committed, but probable cause has to be defined more broad than that. It's not just good probable cause that a crime was committed, but that the particular suspect committed the crime and that the location to be searched is, in fact, that there's probable cause to believe that evidence will be found there. And Leon says that before you can ever get to a hearing, you first have to get past the good faith reliance on what is in front of the magistrate. And in this particular case, there is no probable cause. There's not one fact to suggest that Bill Marquardt had anything to do with the homicide, or one fact to suggest that he had anything to be found in his cabin, which he lived in. His father had a partial ownership in it, but he lived there. It was his place.
Mr. Brinkman, can I interrupt you for a minute? Because you're talking about Leon, and I want to talk about Leon for a minute also.
Yes.
I'm looking at Leon, and it says at one point, talking about the determination of good faith, in making this determination, all of the circumstances, including whether the warrant application had previously been rejected by a different magistrate, may be considered. Now, that suggests to me that indeed, when making the good faith determination, not the probable cause determination, that the court indeed can look at all of the circumstances, including what the officers knew. Now, do you feel that's wrong? And if you feel it's wrong, tell me why, please.
Okay. First of all, when we're talking about the good faith hearing, there's a number of different types of factual situations that Leon looks at. For instance, they look at a mistake of the address, or they look at a situation where they're sending the officers out to the third floor of an apartment building and there's only two places on the third floor, and maybe it has the correct address, but it doesn't say apartment A or B up on the third floor. But one of the apartments is, the door is open and it's clearly, and it's empty, and it's clear that they must be talking about the other apartment. In a case like that, yes, a hearing is allowed to look at facts to show that the officers acted in a good faith. But in that particular case, they've already gotten past the indicia of probable cause. The first thing that has to be found when you look at the search warrant is that you've got that minimum indicia, or are we looking at bare bones? If you're looking at bare bones, you don't get to the good faith hearing. Otherwise, you wouldn't need...
Let me stop you right there, if I might. Leon also says that an officer cannot be expected to question the magistrate's probable cause determination in the ordinary situation, or his judgment that the form of the warrant is technically sufficient. So what you've got here, as I understand it, is a magistrate, a judge, making a determination of probable cause and therefore issuing the search warrant. Now, isn't that an important factor in looking at good faith as far as the officer is concerned?
I believe that in Leon, what was being referred to in that particular situation is a situation where you might have staleness, or you might have an unreliable informant, which was the situation there. And basically, if you have probable cause that is made up of what would otherwise be excluded because of staleness or an unreliable informant, the police officer is not in the position to look at that warrant where there's plenty of probable cause, but under the old standards, part of the probable cause would be thrown away, and second guess the judge and say, well, you know, I think that this is stale, or I think that, you know, maybe this guy isn't as reliable as we made him up to be to the judge. In a situation like that, the officer is not to second guess the magistrate's decision, and basically what Leon does is throws out the use of staleness, and it throws out the use of unreliable informant in the name of objective good faith. But if you start off with nothing, as opposed to Leon, which started off with plenty of good, plenty of probable cause, if you count the staleness and if you count that stuff. But if you start off with nothing, then the officer is in a position to say, then he's not acting in an objective reliance upon that document. And I think that's the distinction that Leon is making when it talks about not second-guessing the magistrate. Certainly, Leon does impose a burden on the officers to have objective, objective good faith. They're the ones who are gathering all the information here. And I'd like to point out that in the application on the 15th of March, basically there's nothing in there that points at all to Bill Marquardt being involved in this homicide. What's important...
Let me ask you a question about that affidavit, Mr. Brink. There's one thing about this case that troubles me, and neither of you have argued it, and it may be because of the focus that Mr. Marquardt at this point was the suspect. But if you look at the affidavit, Investigator Price reports after finding the body of Mary Marquardt, he spoke with her husband. Mr. Marquardt informed him that he and Mary have a son, Bill Marquardt, who since the location of Ms. Marquardt's body had not been seen or heard from. Now, if you step back, and if you are not focusing on the son as the suspect, and you have a homicide, and the son is missing, wouldn't it be prudent for the police to find out if he's okay?
Well, that would have been a consideration that, you know, they didn't take that path. Would it be prudent to see if he was okay? Would it have been prudent to see if you could get consent from the father to go in there? They didn't take that path. Whether or not it's prudent... we don't really have exigent circumstances here that justify that. Nowhere in the search warrant application or nowhere was it discussed at all that the son was in any danger. And probably the reason for that is because the officers in fact did know, and this wasn't brought out at the Eau Claire good faith hearing, but the father had said not that the son was missing for 2 days, but that the son hadn't been seen for about 30 days because he was out of town on vacation down south. So that wasn't really the subjective thought going on at the time. And you have to understand that even though it's a true statement to say the son hadn't been seen in 2 days, the actual statement that was made was the son hadn't been around for a long time. So that... whether it's prudent or not, that wasn't on their mind at the time, and it wasn't documented anywhere. And unfortunately, I did object to the use of the Eau Claire good faith hearing as a basis in this particular case because a number of the facts in that just aren't correct. For instance, the discussion about the note on the refrigerator, that wasn't in fact discussed with the officer until about 2 months later, not 2 days later. That cross-examination never came up at that hearing. And one of the reasons for that is because the good faith hearing was handled in the county that had the cruelty to dogs case, and that attorney was not familiar with all of the necessary facts in the homicide case in order to properly cross-examine. But that note wasn't found for about 2 months, and also there's a conversation with the father that didn't take place until about 6 months later, which was stuck into the probable cause hearing as if those facts existed at the time of the application. Those facts have never been tested in my case. And I continue throughout this hearing today to object to any use of that affidavit because I feel that the legal issues weren't properly handled and the facts weren't properly addressed at that hearing. So, I think that Judge Cameron himself made a very good point when he said that one could easily craft an affidavit containing some indicia of probable cause for further investigation even though no connection between the crime, the suspect, and the location to be searched is there. And that's exactly what we're dealing with in this particular case. It's hard to focus on all of the ramifications of a case like this in a short period of time. But there's just too many mistakes that were made in the good faith hearing, and I think that Leon says to avoid this, you have to have some indicia of probable cause. You have to have some fact that suggests that Bill Marquardt or his residents is going to have some evidence. And what I was going to say before is that they had another search warrant on the 18th, 3 days later, after they found the dogs and the rabbits. But still, they did not, in that affidavit, have any more facts about the homicide. No facts about the homicide were added to the search warrant of the 18th affidavit. And that tells me that they didn't have any at the time. I think that that's a reasonable explanation for it. But I think that that's very important.
Would you address the inevitable discovery argument at the state?
I certainly will. Thank you. What we have here is a situation that has so many variables in it. Number one, as far as the bullets being tested by the crime lab and then compared, but for the fact that on the 15th, the Bill Marquardt's cabin was searched with no probable cause and no Leon objective good faith, the police would never have been in a position, the government would never have been in a position to even consider checking the bullets with the dog that had been shot down the block. It's not a next door neighbor, it's down the block and across the street. Bill Marquardt was not even a suspect in that dog killing. They had other suspects in the dog killing, and if there was any other avenue at that point in time before the 15th that was being researched, it was simply the fact that there was no connection with Bill Marquardt at all. It would never have been inevitable in any common sense use of the word inevitable. For the most part, the cases that I found on inevitable discovery deal with pieces of evidence that are in custody, have already been seized, and it's just a matter of time before they do an inventory search of the vehicle or something of that matter. Here, we're taking about five different major facts that are not connected. There's no logical reason to grab these things and put them together in any inevitability. It's just not there. But they want, and I don't believe that inevitable discovery applies to the fact that they could have just redid the search warrant. I don't believe that there was sufficient facts on the 18th regarding the homicide because nothing new was brought forth in the affidavit. To somehow suggest that they could have taken this knowledge, this subjective knowledge, and redid the warrant, well, they had an opportunity to redo the warrant. They did on the 18th. Nothing new.
Counselor, what about opposing counsel's statement to me when I asked him about this issue that they would do an analysis on both the shell casings found at the scene of the murder and the shell casings found at the scene of the dog shooting, and that they discovered about 5 days after his arrest that those were shot from the same weapon. What about that as a source of inevitable discovery?
I'm sorry, but my understanding is that the shell casings that were found at the cabin matched the shell casings that were found where the dog was shot. It was a different weapon that was used in the homicide.
Okay, I may have misunderstood what
that,
you said.
That the gun that was found in the homicide was actually found in the third search, and they searched on the second search.
I'm not talking about the gun. I was just talking about the shell casings at the scene of the murder and the shell casings. They're both 9mm, apparently, at the shooting of the dog. And I may have misunderstood. I thought that opposing counsel said that those two shell casings, or maybe there were more than two, but from two scenes were being analyzed, and it was determined they came from the same weapon. But I may have misunderstood.
That's not true. The weapon that was, the shell casings that were found at the house originally were the same shell casings that were found in the shooting of the dog down the road.
Yeah, that's what I said.
That's exactly what I was saying.
Well, I thought you meant at the homicide.
Well, I did. And you're saying house meaning his cabin. Gotcha.
I'm talking about where the dog was shot down the block.
Me too.
Yes, okay.
And then I'm talking about the homicide. And you're different saying shots. Those are different weapons that were used, and the shell casing that did match were found in his cabin. The shell casings in the cabin matched those from the dog. Yes? No?
Yes. But they were found after the 15th, after the search of the 15th.
Right.
Not before.
Okay, fine. Thank
not
you.
Not before. Okay.
Thank you. Did the police know he had a gun that would have matched the gun that killed the woman?
Not before the gun. No. In fact, that gun, nothing was said in the early police reports at all about the guns or anything like that. That gun was found in the third search, and police did not know that prior to the 15th. The police did not know that there would be any evidence there. They did not mention one fact. They did not know there would be any evidence there in this cabin that was relevant to the reason they did the search in the first place, and that's the homicide.
Well, Chief Mayor, Counsel, I'm a bit in a quandary, because when we look at good faith and what the police knew, listening to you, I hear different facts than I guess I was assuming that were being alleged that the police knew. For instance, is it that Bill was gone for the last, is it that the defendant was gone for the last 2 days? Or is it that he was gone for the last 30 days is what the police knew? Is it that the dog that was shot was next door, or is it down the street a ways and he was never a suspect? Is it that the shell casings found at the murder scene match the shell casings at the dog scene? And you're telling me no. Hmm?
No, the last one's yes.
Okay. But the other one, so...
But what I'm saying, and I did not have an opportunity to, we did not have a good faith hearing in Chippewa Falls. But what I am saying is that the actual information provided to the police officers, which is in the police reports, says that Bill's father said he hadn't seen him in a month. That was translated into 2 days for purposes of the affidavit.
And isn't that what the police would rely on, is what's in the affidavit?
Well, do the police rely on what's in the affidavit? Well, you know, the police are the ones who provided the information themselves.
No, I understand that. But if the whole issue, or at least one of the issues, is good faith, I thought the whole argument was that you have to rely on the affidavit. So if that seems to be the document we should be looking at.
Well, I understand that also. But we did not have a hearing as to the one of the other. In my brief, I said that we would have had another hearing on the Franks issue of converting the translation of 30 days into 2 days. It's consistent, but it's misleading. And we didn't have that Franks hearing in our case either. We didn't get there. To answer your question again, what we're dealing with is, it was 2 days, not, it was 30 days, not 2 days. And the second point, I can't remember what you said. The third point was the casings. And they were the same as what was found. It's not the next door neighbor. If this is the house, you go across the street and down about three houses. And this is in the country. So we're talking about perhaps, more than a quarter of a mile to where the dog killing was. And they had a different suspect. The owner of the house had provided the police with two suspects, but they were honing in on one of them that they had interviewed, who had a motive to kill the dog because he had made a statement about killing the dog before. So Bill Marquardt was nowhere to be found in that investigation at all.
Thank you. Mr. Professor.
I think you're trying to suggest that somehow there wasn't a fair portrayal of the fact that Bill hadn't been heard from. Father clearly indicated that he had not talked to his son since, I think it was about the time of the mother's birthday.
Yes.
February.
That's correct.
Okay. I don't think there's any dispute about that. But it's also true that the father indicated, I haven't heard from Bill from the time that my wife was murdered. And I mean, this wasn't a secret event.
No, it's not a secret, but if I understand your point, Bill's father did not make that statement, quote, end quote. He didn't say, I haven't heard from my son since the murder. What he said to the police was, I haven't heard from him since her birthday. That's what he said to the police. I mean, I'm not saying that it's inconsistent somehow, that you can translate that into 2 days, but if you have a son who's out of town, out of state, on vacation, it's not unusual in any sense of the word to suggest that, well, I haven't heard from him since the murder, because that you would expect that if they were out of state, down in Texas.
You're saying the inference is different.
That's correct.
That's what you're trying to say. It's a fact you hadn't heard from him, but the inference is different.
That's right.
Your red light is out, and unless there are further questions, we have concluded the hearing on 04AP958CR, 04AP1609CR, State versus Bill Paul Marquardt. And on behalf of the court, I want to thank attorneys Fitzgerald, Freimuth, and Brinkman for the discussion of good faith and inevitable discovery. That concludes our hearing, and I will call the next case.